Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
I've wanted to have a discussion on this particularly serious, critical issue of child and teenage pregnancies in this country. And I'm delighted to have with me and congratulate her for staying with me, because we started talking about this before all the Chagim. So as I said, I feel like I've been on a sabbatical. I'd like to welcome Alexandra Abrahams, who is the DA Shadow Minister of Social Spokesperson and the DA spokesperson on social development, and has been involved with the DA since 2009 and has extensive experience on the portfolio committee of social development and on oversight in general. Alexandra, thank you very much for joining me and for staying the course.
Yes, thank you. Good morning, and thank you for having me so we can talk about this very, very serious topic.
Alexandra, it came to my attention, I saw, I think it was a press release in which you were talking of launching a national probe into the staggering child pregnancy pandemic. Can you just give a brief idea of what the extent of this pandemic is? Because I think one of the horrifying things is, I think most people will instinctively respond to the idea of particularly underaged girls falling pregnant, and all the consequences that has, that go with that. But we're looking at children as low as the age of 10 being subject to this. What's South Africa's situation with this? What sort of crisis have we found ourselves in?
So some of the data that we've come across suggests that there's approximately one in every seven mothers in South Africa who are now teenagers. And in 2022/2023, it estimates there's 150,000 girls between the ages of 10 and 19 who fall pregnant. And then, of course, there's a disturbingly number of girls under the age of 15, where reports indicated that, nearly 10 births daily are to girls who are 15 years and younger. And in South Africa, the age of sexual consent is 16 years old. So that means that this category of girls could not necessarily have given consent to engage in that sexual activities, which resulted in them being pregnant. And I think the other crisis that we find ourselves in here is it's a complex issue, in that it involves health concerns. A body at that age, a young girl's body at that age, isn't ready to actually have a pregnancy and give birth to a child. So that puts them at greater risk for maternal complications later down the line. It also puts them at risk for contracting STDs and HIV, and of course, low survival for the baby. So the baby's health is also at stake here. Mm. And then of course it moves on to, the stigma that's attached to this, in that, children are raising children before they are adults. So that robs them of their childhood. And then of course the social stigma of, if that child is, raised maybe by a relative and raised then as your brother or as your sister, that further adds another layer of complexity to the family unit. And then, another aspect is, of course, educational. Mm. Not all the girls that then finish matric and go on to further their education and go on to, get better work opportunities. So that limits their opportunities as well. And then, of course, the issue of that it's a crime, that it's sex with a minor under the age of 16 is considered a crime in South Africa. So it's a very serious crisis with lots of layers to it.
Mm. I know you and I both have children, and even in the best of circumstances, pregnancy is a traumatic experience. I mean, yes. It's unpredictable, and it does plays havoc on your body. And the idea that this should somehow be the crisis that it is. To what extent, since we'd regard it pretty much unthinkable that it should be perpetuated, to what extent does poverty and high levels of unemployment encourage this sort of this culture that persists, you know, persists well into the 21st century? Where are those factors that aggravate the current epidemic, if I can put it that way?
Yes, so there's no doubt that it is taking place in our more poverty-stricken communities. But if I can just use an example when we speak about poverty, I was recently in Mandini in KZN. The Portfolio of Committee on Social Development held a public meeting there. And there was a father who stood up, and his pain and emotion was raw and it laid bare to us. And his story in a nutshell was that he's unemployed, he got retrenched, never found work. His wife had passed on and left him to raise his children, their girl children. And he tells him every single day that no matter what you need, you come to me. Even if I don't have a job, I'll find a way to provide for you. Even if you need sanitary pads, you come to me. And his reason was he doesn't want his daughters to have to sell their bodies for the basic necessities that a father should provide. And I share this story because I was reminded in that yes, poverty is limiting, and it limits your choices and it limits your opportunities, and it can be a gateway to so many things like gangsterism and drugs and, you know, just a lot of things. And even parents exploiting their own children or taking hush money or bribes to stay quiet, or even not even money, but even food, taking food to stay quiet. But even in poverty, Seda, there is right and wrong and good and evil. Mm. And I say this because a parent's role and government's role as well is to protect our children. Mm. And this father, as poor as what he is, as what's stuck in poverty that he is, he can still make the distinction between right and wrong. So I don't believe that poverty is always can be used as an excuse if there are situations where parents can do the right thing by their daughters.
Then, of course, the question is asked: is since all this activity for children under the age of 16 is unlawful, it's illegal, it is a crime. To what extent do we have to look at the fact that the various governments, national and provincial, actually have to be proactive in charging men for these crimes, particularly as it's in the overall scheme of things, particularly with current forensic methods, it's really easy to effectively, I mean, obviously resources notwithstanding, to prove that a rape has occurred.
Yes. So maybe if we first go back to what the law says. So there's two pieces of legislation at play here. And the first piece is the Children's Act. And in section 110, it speaks about reporting the abuse of neglected child and children in need of care and protection. And that section you have to read with section 305, which then says that it is an offence to not report suspected cases of sexual assault with a minor. So that responsibility is then the Department of Social Development, the Department of Health. So when the girls are arriving in your clinics and your hospitals, and at school, the basic education department, teachers and principals, they all have an obligation to report that to the Department of Social Development, directly to SAPS or to child protection organizations. And there's a reporting form that needs to be used. It's a Form 22. You can Google the form. It's in the Children's Act. And that must be submitted. So that's government's role, but it's also civil society, all of our role. We all have that responsibility to do. And then there's also the Criminal Law Amendment Act, Chapter 3, that also speaks to this, that also obligates everybody to report this as a case. And the reason we've launched this probe and trying to find out where the legislative gaps are, where the policy gaps are, and the operational gaps are, because once again, at that same public meeting in KZN Mandini, a girl stood up and she said, I anonymously reported a case of where a child was being raped to a social worker. And the social worker did not act. She even went as far as to get more information for the social worker. And when she returned back to the shack, that the sexual assault was taking place in. She said she had found that the family had moved. So here we have an actual case of where a social worker who is obligated by law to act that did not act, and there that child is gone forever, you know, and probably unspeakable things are still taking place and occurring with that child. So that is what the law says, and yeah.
Is it the sort of culture of the sort of the unjustified stigma on the essentially on the victim and the victim's family that prevents social workers from doing their job? And I would have thought teachers would be often people who would know sooner than most that there has been activity of this nature. Is it so inculcated in culture? Is it fear? Is it incompetence? Do you have any idea from investigation yet what factors you're looking at?
So we don't have any idea just yet. I mean, these are just the odd cases that come to our attention, hence launching the probe. And what we've done, we've asked all of our members of in the provincial legislatures to submit a series of written questions to the minister, the MECs of social development, of health, and then at a national level, we are also sub and basic education. And then at a national level, we are also submitting questions to Justice for the MPA and to SAPS. And we're trying to ascertain why the reporting is not happening. And if we just look at schools recently, I think it was this week that I can't get to the publication right now, but there was an article where young girls have now come forward long after they've, not long after, but soon after they've finished school to tell their stories of how principals and teachers have been sexually abusing them at school and even taking them to go have abortions, you know, so that they're not caught out. So I actually think it's a and something that we need to, you know, investigate further is that it's actually got to do with the person. There are a lot of predators that are lurking in our midst. And one of the questions we are also seeking clarity on is the status of our child protection register, because these individuals' names are supposed to be on that register so that they aren't allowed to work with children and they aren't allowed to be in our schools. So that is why we're coming back to say there must be some gaps in how the law and how the policies are being applied, that we are still in the situation where we're seeing an increased number of girls falling pregnant. And if I can just tap on to the National Prosecuting Authority, earlier this year I put in a written question to them to try and understand if we're seeing for the number of girls falling pregnant in this category, are we seeing the same number of convictions for statutory rape? And for the financial period 2023 to 2024, the MPA confirmed that there were only 150 convictions
Good
for
heavens.
statutory rape. Yes, that is
We're the rape capital
extremely
of the
low.
world.
Yes. And they also then went on to further to say that as of September 2024, there were 323 cases that were currently before the courts. And, you know, they went on to give other stats about four cases being postponed. But the other question I also ask is, do you keep a record of cases that are being withdrawn and for what? And they said, no, they don't keep the reasons for the withdrawals, but they could tell me that for that period, 81 cases were withdrawn. And you know, those cases are largely where parents are then being, you know, given some money or given some food to say, you know, please withdraw the case. But we won't know that unless we ask the questions. And if we go to the MPA and say, can you please, you know, get the reasons for it, then at least we'll know going forward what we're dealing with. And also to say, we do understand that there are children having sexual intercourse with children and therefore falling pregnant. We know that that is also an issue, and that requires, you know, more sexual education in schools and so forth. But we need to start somewhere, and we starting with the law, and we starting with the cases that pertain to statutory rape. And we also understand that not every girl is going to fall pregnant from statutory rape. But once again, if we start getting those cases and putting those perpetrators behind bars, hopefully the victims and their families will then find faith in the criminal justice system again and come forward. And the perpetrators will also think twice before committing this terrible offense.
Of course, it raises the question that is raised in every aspect of our society, and that is faith in the police services, the preparedness and the ability and the manpower to do the work. Are there any units or sort of specialities that one can put the government, the police services can draw on to help in this regard, or is it just, are we in such a desperate state, looking at the general state of internecine and fighting and corruption in our police services on a broader scale?
So there is a unit within the police services that deals specifically with sexual assault. It's just slipped my mind right now. But also a lot of police stations also have victim-friendly rooms. So the services are there. It's just obviously a lot of people are afraid to come forward. You know, in this article, it said how the girls were told that they'll kill their families, that they'll kill them if you speak about it. So there's a lot of that fear that still exists. And, you know, a lot of the girls that come forward and then their case, just nothing happens to their case because the court case in itself takes so long due to backlogs and so forth. And that is why I know we saw recently that they're now looking at legislation for the specialized sexual offences court. So that will be a good thing and a step in the right direction to addressing this.
I've looked at the question more broadly in over time with regard to the attitudes of young men to women. And certainly from my experience in the high school environments on governing bodies, you almost literally see a well-behaved boy, particularly if he's, you know, often with single, coming from a single parent household with sisters and a mother and not many father figures, beautifully behaved. They hit puberty and they seem to be subject to every bad influence, and their brains just can't cope with the changes they're making. And then once they get to like the age of 17, their negative attitudes towards women have settled. Is tackling that sort of issue at school level have the possibility of overcoming the stigma or limiting it at least?
Well, here's the thing. These girls aren't getting pregnant by themselves. So the boys, they have a role to play as well. And, you know, when we speak about, you know, sexual education in school, that's about one component of it. But then society has another responsibility to play. And I speak about your TV programs. I speak about your artists who are producing music videos and lyrics and, you know, all of those, that media group and beyond. And the request to them would be, is please be mindful in the content that they are producing. So not to romanticize and glamorize, you know, sexual activity, and also normalize certain behaviors like sugar daddies and, you know, those kind of aspects, to be mindful of what they are putting out there, because children are so young on these social media platforms, and it is sometimes so difficult to regulate what they are viewing and looking on these platforms. And that is also where they're picking up. And you know, one of the colleagues in our committee always says it's almost like it's become fashionable to be pregnant in a school uniform. And that's something we need to denounce, and we need our influencers and our personalities and every person that has a position of influence that can speak to this generation, because it's a completely different generation we are dealing with, who can speak to them and guide them that, yes, if you're going to have sex, practice it safely and practice it in a consensual environment. But know that if you are going to fall pregnant, your choices in life is going to be so much harder, because that baby is in a very expensive price tag. You know, and it also limits your future opportunities.
Absolutely, yeah. That's key for the progress of women.
And also to say, I've also heard some comments, not really rooted in fact, but in passing, that they say, oh, but the girls are falling pregnant for a 500 and now 60 rand child support grant. And I say to that, I can't see anybody who wants to bring life into this world knowing that a 560 rand is going to sustain that child for a month. The cost of living is so ridiculous that 560 rand, a child support grant, is not going to be sufficient to sustain you and that baby until that child is 18 years old. So, yeah.
Alexandra, thank you very much for coming on a topic that really spans all our economic and social problems in this country. Thank you for joining me.
Yes, and maybe just in closing to say, it's not for the mothers that have fallen pregnant. It's also not the end of the road per se. I've seen so many young mothers who have risen to the occasion, who have shown tremendous strength and courage and resilience to actually further their lives. So it's not to say that it's all doom and gloom and you're never going to amount to something. Some women have really persevered and have made incredible moms and have gone on to have successful lives and careers. With our support, of course.
Thank you. Much
Thank you.
appreciated.